This is Jazz Talk, presented by Melbourne International Jazz Festival. We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay respects to their elders past, present and future, as well to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the wider Melbourne community and beyond. We are honoured to contribute to over 60,000 years of music making, knowledge sharing and storytelling that has taken place on this land. I'm Chelsea Wilson, Artistic Associate of Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress. This session, titled Panic at the Distro, was recorded at Melbourne Recital Centre as part of Melbourne Jazz Congress 2021. From releasing independently through to the major labels, this conversation examines how to release your recordings and reach audiences. Hear from experts, including Sony A&R manager Marietta Uzo, Bandcamp artist and label ambassador for Australia and New Zealand, and artist manager of Mildlife, Will Evans, artist and producer Jake Mason, Northside Records owner and 3RRR broadcaster Chris Gill, regional manager of Australia and New Zealand Ditto Music, Sarah Hamilton, and ABC Jazz presenter Dr. Megan Burslem. This is Panic at the Distro at Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress. So we have 50 minutes of power. It's an express panel. The great news is afterwards we can all go and enjoy a beverage at Blondie. So if there's anything we don't get to cover, you might be able to have a chat to one of the panelists, so please join us straight after this. But I have asked everybody if they could give us a one-sentence summary of what they do. We might start with you, Jake.
Thanks, Chelsea. I'm a bit of a jack of all trades. I have, I'm an artist and I have a record label and a recording studio, so I kind of float between all the different sectors.
Hello, thanks for having me. I'm Sarah Hamilton from Ditto Music. So I run the Australia-New Zealand operations. We are music distribution, getting your music onto digital platforms, and then sometimes promoting it as well.
Hi everyone, my name's Megan. I'm a host of Mornings on ABC Jazz, so I basically keep people company and play jazz.
I'm Chris. I have a radio show also on 3RRR, Get Down, and I have a record store, Northside Records, and a record label, brilliantly entitled Northside Records. And I'm a dancer, please.
It's true. Hello, I'm Will Evans. I work at Bandcamp. I'm a kind of the artist and label rep for Bandcamp for Australia and New Zealand. And if you don't know, Bandcamp is basically a big online record store and music community.
And you're also an artist manager?
I also manage an artist called Mildlife.
Who won an ARIA?
Who did win?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Marietta. I work at Sony Music in A&R, and I'm also part of the management team for Tones and I. To sum up what I do, I sign artists and help bring their creative vision to life.
I'm also a dancer.
Yes. Yeah. Marietta, I'm going to start with you. I'd love to dive into the world of A&R. Can you talk to us a little bit about how many new artists actually get signed to Sony every year?
Yeah. I think it can vary from year to year for sure. On average, maybe around 5 to 10, I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm. And how do you know they're the right artist to sign?
Oh, it's a great question. Personally, for me, it always comes back to the song and good music. And then I love diving into the creative vision that the artist has and also, you know, what they have to say and how they want to say it and how they want to express themselves through the music, I think, is really important. So it's a variety of different things that you kind of look at, and for me at the end of the day it comes down to that that kind of gut instinct that you have, just that kind of like, I have to work with this artist.
And sometimes there are multiple labels that are all pursuing one particular artist. Mm-hmm.
What recommendations do you have for a musician in terms of choosing what label they might want to partner with?
I would also say follow your gut with that, and go with the people that care most about you and you feel that connection with.
And, oh, yes, Chris.
Can I have a question for Mariana? So just in terms of Sony and signing jazz artists, I remember when you signed the great Billy Davis.
Yes, and who I saw at Northside Records.
Stop it.
Who also worked with Ditto for a time.
Oh, gosh. So are there any more jazz cats coming out on Sony since Billy? Or
not.
Hit Mildlife's pretty
not
good.
Not locally, I would say, in the last couple of years. Internationally, so I work mostly with our domestic roster in A&R, but obviously Sony's a global company and has many different, you know, labels overseas. So, lots coming through from the US. But nothing locally.
We should chat.
Yes.
A great source of discovery, Northside Records.
Absolutely. So I know you've also got a background in marketing and PR and putting kind of campaigns around how to promote records. How long do you wait till after you've finished recording an album? How long does it take to put the plan together before you actually release it? What's the project management look like?
Well, I mean, I'd love to say as much time as possible. Take your time with it. I know it's kind of one of those things when you're working with an artist, you know, they spend so much time working on the music and, you know, maybe recording it for a year, 2 years, even longer. And there's this eagerness to want to just release it straight away. But, you know, it does take time to kind of plan all of that out. It really, you know, you've just got to get everything in order, basically, creatively, all the visuals. If we're talking an album, you know, you want a couple of videos for each of your kind of key singles, and then really get together with the team and figure out the overall marketing and promotional rollout of it.
So in a major label context, what is the team? Like, how many people are we talking about are actually working on an album to try and make that a success?
Oh, it can be the whole company, you know, which is about 100, 150 people. But there's a core team. So in that core team, you have, you know, you have your A&R, you have your marketing lead, you have your publicity person, you have a, like, social media manager, audience development manager, you have legal, you have finance, all those bits and pieces. Everyone's there working together to make sure, you know, it's the best possible plan.
So I know I kind of mentioned this backstage, but I did hear that only 1 out of 10 releases recoup, as in only 1 out of 10 albums makes the money back that it, you know, is that true?
I don't have the facts of whether that's true or false. It also depends on what the advance looks like for that artist, which can really vary, and how much, you know, so that's basically how much is spent across the album campaign, how much money the artist has to kind of make back in order to start, you know, making that. So it really depends on what that kind of figure is.
Yeah.
But it's hard. It's hard, yeah.
Even when you have a full team and 150 people, how do you cut through all the noise and make sure an album really sells?
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately it needs to resonate with people, but people need to hear about it and connect with it.
Yeah.
It's a huge undertaking.
Yes.
So for independent artists, they kind of need to do all of those things. But I guess a lot of artists might think, if I sign with a label like that, life becomes very easy for me because all these people are going to do stuff for me. But I don't think that's necessarily true, because it's a partnership, right? So can you describe
absolutely.
A little bit how that partnership works? So maybe the artist is given an advance to help them make the record, but sometimes you might sign an artist who's already made the album.
Yep, that's right. So in that scenario, I guess there's different deal types as well. So say if, you know, an artist that we sign already has that body of work finished and kind of has that creative vision for it, we would look at doing a license deal for that artist. And that basically, you know, means that they would get an advance in order to kind of create those different bits and pieces needed to release the body of work. And then, you know, then we would kind of work together. As I said, it's a partnership, you know, it's a business partnership, and we need to work with the artist in order to make the body of work, you know, the best success possible.
I'm going to move to Jake now. You're an artist, you've got your own label, but you have established distribution networks abroad to put your music into stores digitally and physically in other territories. How do you go about finding the right partners in those areas to work with, and how does that relationship work?
Well, when I first began, it was this kind of, I'm going to take over the world kind of approach. And I soon realised that you need to find your clan or your posse of people, and to start really small. So whether that's Northside Records or whether that's your social media following that's into the music that you're making. And so you sort of start this, I guess, in a, you know, what will probably end up being super fans and people that really support you, that you just keep working and finding new people that will contribute to that idea, I guess, of you start pedaling the bike and then other people will join on. And so from a distribution perspective, you meet people along the way that are passionate about the music that you do. I guess it's the sort of the opposite approach to a major label, where it's all in, let's make a massive scene, where this is kind of the slow burn.
And you've had experience as an artist working with major labels, being signed to independent labels, putting out your own label. So you've kind of done the whole mix. Can you talk a little bit about those deals, such as licensing to a label as opposed to signing with the label, and what the difference is between those?
Yeah, so I guess it's a bit about investment, I think. You know, the more money someone contributes to a project, whether it's a record label, whether it's a license deal or it's a full deal, the more investment that they have and the more return that they need to get on their investment. So, and it's also about risk as well. So I guess there's varying levels of that, and it probably comes down to how many different ideas you want to have in the mix. You know, the more people that are involved, there's more ideas. And so if you're a DIY artist and then you've got really strong ideas, I think it's really important that you know, retain ownership of your masters and maybe do a license deal or have, you know, set up your own distribution networks. But if you're more just interested in, say, writing the songs and recording them, but you're more than happy to leave it to somebody else, then yeah, great, have, you know, go for a big major label deal.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And can you talk about also different territories? So I know that, you know, there's, you can have an example of you're independent in Australia, but maybe you're with a label that take care of other countries. Something we talked about in our session this morning was accessing international markets and what that might look like, and how you can juggle your time between focusing on your fan base and your projects at home while trying to develop audiences elsewhere. So can you talk about that as a strategy, that you're independent here but maybe you have label support elsewhere?
Yeah, well, so the band Cooking on Three Burners, which I've been a member of for quite a while, that was literally the way we had it set up. We had we took care of our own territory, Australia, and then we had a label, Freestyle Records, that took care of the rest of the world, so to speak. And that was great for us because we could learn a bit about what labels did through them, but also because we had our following here and also lots of connections here, then we could kind of, you know, work our own market. And then I guess, depending how much time you've got to spend, you could have a special deal for every territory if you wanted to. But, you know, territories are quite different. You know, people interact differently. You know, certain styles and genres of music work better in different territories. And so it goes back to that when you find your clan. And for us, it was like, well, the UK and Europe was really central to us and Australia. So we really focused on those territories rather than getting too worried about what was happening in China or Russia or, you know.
And I guess some of the benefits about staying independent in Australia gives you the rights to manufacture your own copies.
Absolutely.
To sell at shows.
To sell at shows. And also it gives you the opportunity to, if you get a deal, a sync or something like that, which is great for financing records where, you know, maybe you haven't made much money from that department. You obviously don't have the label involved in that. But, I mean, it all takes work. And so not to say having a label working for you is a bad thing, but it just depends. If you can control your own market, then it might be better to go down that path. But as I, you know, there's never a perfect fit.
I think it's just good to know what your options are and be informed about those options. And particularly if you do sign to a label that's in the UK, but then you're doing a gig here and then you don't have any copies of your own music to sell to people at the gig, you're missing that stream of revenue. And, you know, to have to buy back copies of your own music from a label on the other side of the world might work for you, might not work for you.
Yeah.
So it's just about having those options. So, Chris, I'd like to talk a little bit about bricks and mortar stores.
Bricks and mortar stores are your friends. And we are there to help promote music. And we believe that if you sort of take the plunge and put yourself on vinyl or cassette or CD or physical format, then we think that that's a sign of you saying to people, I think my music is special enough to be on this format as well. And then it's sort of like there's, for instance, in Melbourne, there's like maybe 60 to 70 independent record stores. There's also lots of other JB Hi-Fi, you know, we won't talk about them, but they're still part of the mix. So, but it's more, the independent stores are sort of owner-operated and they're like, each store has a bit of a vibe as to what that person, that owner-operator, is involved in. So, like Jake was saying, it's about finding your sort of clan. And, you know, my store sort of likes to promote soul music and its friends. And we sort of focus on that. So it's like rock music, we don't really kind of go out of our way to sort of promote that at all because there's 59 other stores in Melbourne doing that. So I find if you do what you love well, you know, then it sort of speaks for itself. I think bricks and mortars are very important because it means that your music is working for you in another space. So, you know, you're making music, and I think bricks and mortar also play a good part, not just promoting it locally for you, but if you get your distribution set up overseas, if people at home see the fact that it's selling overseas and it's reviewed overseas, then that helps your sales locally, like exponentially. So I always suggest to people don't just aim at a domestic market. It's a world. You live in a world. And people all over the world love music. So you just, like Jake was saying, you know, you got to find out where or who could distribute your stuff overseas to get it to the spots. I mean, you know, sort of in our sort of music, there's not a lot of stores, but the stores that do it are really passionate. And we do distribute music overseas. So we have distribution points in the US and the UK who will take, you know, will fill up a box of local Melbourne music. And the fact that you're saying you come from Melbourne in your music, that's a passport to funky success right now. So use that as your promo because once people say, oh, you're a Melbourne musician, they will give it another listen. Oh, Queen has entered the building. Sorry, please. I'm trying to concentrate. Oh, my God. What's your belt? I can't think anymore.
Okay, so can you... Thank you for that, Chris, but can you tell us a little bit about how the mechanics of it actually work? So could you tell us what consignment is?
So consignment is if you press your records up, then you pay for your own records be it CDs or cassettes, you come into the record store and say, would you like to sell my record? And if you physically give the record store, say, let's say 10 copies, generally, it's probably best if the record store pay upfront, because it costs money to produce vinyl. It's not a cheap thing to have, say, out of 10 records, you know, if it was like small ones, they maybe cost you 10 bucks. That's 100 bucks if you're sitting there. So ideally, consignment was a thing with CDs in the past. Record stores understand now that these do cost, so they sort of will pay up front. And if we pay up front, then we probably wouldn't necessarily take 10, unless, you know, Mildlife walk into the building. You'd take 100. But it's different, you know, like if...
Come out tomorrow then.
Well, yeah,
take
we'll
note.
Be ready. Yeah. But certain bands, you know you'll be able to sell a few. You'll take more because then you'll sort of promote them. And the more you have on hand, the better it is, because you can make noise on behalf of that musician to try and promote their stuff. And give it to us, please. Yeah.
Give the man the music. So you were saying before there's about 60 to 70 record stores across Melbourne. Mm-hmm. If you were going to drive around and give copies of your record to each one of those stores, I mean, that would be quite a time-consuming job, and also chasing up with every single one. You know, did you sell the copies? You know, do you owe me money? Can I bring you more in? So hence, enter the role of a distributor.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about the relationship between stores and the distributors?
There's a few distributors in town. There's a new one that's just started up, Flightless, which is the King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard band sort of like, you know, label. They've just started up. There's Rocket Distribution. And then in Sydney, there's Inertia, and MGM is another one, a big one. I mean, there's a few more, but distribution houses generally act as like local hubs for sharing the music. Unfortunately now, they're gonna not necessarily go to a young artist and take the young artist's music. They're gonna maybe wait until there's a bit more of an established act to ensure that they will be selling at least 100 plus copies to make it worth their while. It's just a sort of financial reality. And, you know, the local distribution people, I've sort of implored them to take young artists on who I think are amazing. But, you know, obviously sometimes I live in a bubble. So it's a funky bubble.
But that is, you know, and I guess even maybe 10 years ago was a more standard model, that as an independent artist you could not sign with a label, but instead sign with a distributor, and they would take care of making sure your stock got into stores and would take a percentage of that, and the store would ring the distributor. So it was, there was that sort of middleman, you know, middle operation between the two.
Often now it's those distribution people who'll ensure you get into JB Hi-Fi. So it's... a lot of that is the promise that a lot of them would make to an artist to go through a distribution. Otherwise, a lot of people are doing the distribution themselves. You'll find if you make sort of genre-specific music like soul music or hip-hop or something like that, then there's literally 5 stores in Melbourne that would specialise in that sort of music, so you could pretty much handle that yourself. I mean, you don't have to go to a distribution person for that. Then they take a cut. It's quite a difficult industry nowadays with... you know, trying to fit in and sort of, the distribution places are struggling. However, now, since the pandemic, people are really jumping back on board with records, because people are making their caves funky and they're sort of like making sure they're just at home buying online. So actual getting the records is really difficult. So distribution places have a new role in that they are able to source, because they can get sort of... big quantities.
Let's talk about the artist direct-to-fan model, Bandcamp.
Yes.
How can we maximise the Bandcamp platform as independent artists and try and generate new fans and get the word out?
That's a very large question. It's really about kind of knowing the community that you're a part of. I think when you're an independent artist and you use Bandcamp, you know, potentially you might be thinking, oh, I'm putting it up on this website and I've got access to, you know, millions and millions of people. But it's not that dissimilar to what Chris is saying about record stores and, you know, your local communities. You're putting something up, you need to be aware that there's a target audience, I guess. So you can't just go up there and be like, oh, I'm going to be the next big thing or whatever. Not that, you know, that's the focus of people using Bandcamp, as I'm sure some people are aware. But, yeah, the focus has got to be the community in the same way that it has to be when you're doing shows, when you're doing, you're taking stock to record stores. It's about, one, telling people that it's there is obviously the biggest part of being successful on Bandcamp, because there's plenty of people that don't do that fundamental thing of letting their fans know that it exists for them to give them money for. But yeah, I think knowing the community that you're a part of, whether it's physically or digitally, is probably the most important part.
And how should artists know if they should invest in pressing vinyl or manufacturing CDs?
That's a good question. I think you don't want to be sitting, like realistically, you don't want to be sitting in a room in your house with boxes everywhere. As someone who's been doing that for 10 years, I really am sure lots of people doing the same thing. It's not a good time and your partner's going to hate you and there's no room for your dog. So I think you've got to be realistic about that. I think, you know, there are minimums that you have to be aware of, and, you know, you have to be confident that you're going to, or at least have a plan if it's like, you know, we're going to be touring, we're going to be doing lots of shows, so there's going to be lots of opportunities for us to get rid of this. You know, get rid of, that's bad use of words, but sell this merchandise. You want to have a plan of how to get rid of it. But I think, you know, I haven't heard anyone talk about there being like a, you know, if someone's gone to the effort of doing it, then there's a respect, and, you know, you should want to be pushing that if you can actually go down the rabbit hole of making it.
I think Maria Amato from Air was also saying that, you know, you can always ask your audience, would you like this on record? You know, is this something you would purchase, you know, or doing pre-orders or things like that? But I guess it's pretty genre dependent.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. I mean, I also should definitely use this opportunity to say Bandcamp has a vinyl pressing service that is basically a kind of crowdfunded situation. So you can always do something like that and get as close as you possibly can to...
Like the crates, sort of?
Yeah, yeah, but it's kind of just exists within the Bandcamp platform. And, yeah, you can't jump ahead of any queues if that's going to be any question about production. It does not solve that issue.
Okay. Sarah, can we talk a little bit about digital distribution?
For sure.
And what kind of relationship artists can have with aggregators? Because you can't just go direct to Spotify or iTunes. You need to go through a distributor to support you in that.
Yeah, that's right. I think Spotify were going to dabble in that area and then went, no, thank you, we're not going to do that anymore. But anyone can put their music online through a digital distribution company like Ditto, DistroKid, GyroStream. There's all different kinds and there's different services that are available. So at Ditto, we have offices around the world. There's about 25. We have about 500,000 artists, so there's a lot. And so we work with anyone, any genre, to put their music onto the platforms. But then with some artists, we also work with them more closely to then try and get their music heard more via playlists and that kind of thing. So, you know, Spotify, Deezer, Apple, most of those platforms will have playlists. And the playlists have editors who are curating them, similar to a music director at a radio station. They're people that listen to music, that are involved in the music community. So part of my job is identifying artists that we want to work with on that level and then putting their music in front of the editors. And I think what everyone was saying about thinking more globally is really exciting if you're a jazz musician, soul artist, because Australia's great, but we're a pretty small, you know, community population-wise. But in the UK or Europe, for example, if you can tap into key people or editors of a playlist in the UK, you know, for example, then you could still get your music heard on a more global level. So there's different ways of working together. And, you know, it's good to just have a conversation with your distributor and see exactly what they'll do, because you don't want to think that they're going to be promoting your music when they're actually just putting it onto the platform. So for most of our artists, like 95%, We'll put it onto the platform, we'll make sure your royalties flow back to you, but we won't actively promote it. So just be clear about what they're going to do exactly. And then if you can, and if you feel like it's a good fit, perhaps they'll want to pitch your music to these playlist editors. And usually that's done with a distribution deal, a licensing deal, and a split in royalties. So they might take 10, 15, 20% in order to do that. But that also means that they will be discerning with who they're going to take on board. So when we're chatting to an artist and thinking about whether we're going to put them under the subscription plan or the Ditto Plus plan, we'll look at a few things like, you know, the music itself, first and foremost, that's the most important thing. You know, what playlists exist that we'd be able to put that music, you know, forward to. The team around something, you know, we do look at stats and monthly listeners and all that kind of thing as well. So we look at a few things, but that can be a good option to get your music heard a bit more globally or at least put in front of editors as well.
Mm-hmm. And can you speak to, and maybe Will and Marietta might be able to speak on this one as well, is anyone buying and downloading music anymore or do people just stream?
In some genres.
What, like, is iTunes Store still a thing?
It's still a thing. There was a bit of confusion a few years ago when everyone thought iTunes had died and we're just like, it's done. And I was like, no, it's still there. But what we find, and I'd love to hear from you guys as well, but it's certain genres. So country music, lots of downloads happening. And I will always suggest they do a pre-order on iTunes if they're a country artist. We have this artist called James Johnston who's just been going off in country world. And he had something like 3,000 downloads on iTunes of his debut single. And I was like, okay, great. But we also work with a lot of hip hop and there's not a lot of downloads happening in that space. But I've heard that in the jazz world, there's still, you know, people like to purchase and own, but whether that's on vinyl or, you know, on iTunes, I'm not too sure. But what do you guys think?
CDs even is still a
thing
in jazz.
Yeah.
The demographic, because, you know, a lot of the older jazz audiences got rid of their turntables in 1990 and bought CD players because everyone was told this is a superior technology and they haven't all gone and bought turntables again.
In CD world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've also had a few conversations with some jazz musicians a few years ago about the fact that I think Spotify needs to create some more jazz playlists because, you know, there needs to be the playlists for people like me to pitch to and the playlists will create more audience. But a lot of people, and I can completely understand this, had a bit of an aversion to promoting themselves on Spotify because they were making revenue through CD sales and I totally respect that. And my viewpoint is you as the artist can make the decision that you want to make, but it's good to be aware of what's happening out there and the way people are listening to and consuming music, because there might be a new strategy that you could try to try something different. Like something that's been pretty big over the last couple of years is this idea of waterfalling tracks. Mm-hmm. So instead of just releasing single album, you could choose to release, say, 5 or 6 singles, and every time you release a new single, you put the previous single underneath it, like a little waterfall, and that way it will capture some more listeners. So that could be something that you could try, you know, just as something new to do to try and engage the algorithm on Spotify and build up some fans on that platform, if that was a goal for you. But if you really want to, you know, release on Bandcamp and get your record in Northside and that's your goal and Spotify is not your thing, that's totally fine as well.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, you go.
Oh, well, on the download stuff, it's definitely genre specific. I think on Bandcamp, electronic music on digital downloads is still a really big thing because there's a lot of like single track purchases for DJs and that kind of in that more of that world. But then on the like art, music, jazz adjacent side of stuff, you know, a lot of the songs are one song for a whole record and it's 60 minutes and, you know, people can buy that, download that with a FLAC file and put it on their ridiculous, crazy hi-fi system and sit there and be like, loving it, which is a good vibe. But, and I think that it's purely just genre-specific, I think.
I think also to add to that, genre-specific but also audience-specific as well. So if the, you know, if the artist has an audience that sort of sits in a kind of older demographic, you find that, you know, they're used to what they know, and that's iTunes downloads or
and
CDs.
Facebook.
Yeah, yeah, Facebook.
Facebook marketing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. So I think that impacts it as well. But overall, we've seen a massive decline in iTunes downloads. And I find also if the artist has a more commercial appeal, iTunes downloads will be more.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it's also worth just quickly noting that you shouldn't kind of, yeah, you should still put your stuff up for sale because you, yeah, you shouldn't underestimate how much people want to actually just give you money for being artists.
Mm-hmm.
Something that has been a big thing on Bandcamp in the last 2 years. People want to give you money because they like your music and they understand the plight of you as an artist and the industry as a whole. Don't want to be too negative about that, but people want you to have their money for your art, and that's a good thing. And if it's a lot, then great. If it's like a little bit, it's still free money because, well, it's not free because you made art, but if that was 2 years ago, great.
Mm, and you can direct people on how you want them to support you. Like do a direct call to action saying, please buy my album and, you know, or please go to iTunes. You can direct them on where you want them to go. And, yeah, I've seen that a lot, especially during COVID, of people just wanting to support. And some people don't know how, so you've got to tell them.
And a great way to get the word out is radio. And we've got a few broadcasters on this panel.
Nice segue.
Yeah.
Well done.
Woo. Megan Burslem here from ABC Jazz Mornings. Wanted to ask you, as an artist, how can you get airplay? And specifically, how can you get airplay on ABC Jazz?
Yeah, great questions. I think the first thing is to do your research, to know, I think this kind of came up earlier, is to know where you're going, what music they play, does your music fit? I think that's the first thing, because if your music doesn't fit, for example, if you're sending ABC Jazz something that is completely Triple J, we would probably say, hey, thank you. This is a bit more Triple J. Having said that, pitching is really important. Look, basically we've got a website and it's got Contact Us. We're a national network 24/7 radio station, and our staff is a staff of four people. So it is a very, very small team. So your music, everyone who contacts us. And I think that's a really important thing to kind of know and understand, is that, yeah, your music will come directly to us. We use a software program to actually program the music. It's hand-programmed and programmed with the help of a software program, which is across Triple J, Double J, Unearthed, Jazz Classic country. And that basically says what time of day your music would suit. Obviously, you're not going to have something really out there and full on at 7:30 in the morning. You might have something that's a little bit more mornings appropriate. But basically, if you email and say, here's my music, here's a high-res file of my music and a bit of story on me, and it's like, great, then your music will be immediately put into the library. So it's quite a straightforward system there. And because we actually work with a software, it makes it a really wonderful, it pops up often with the help of this software, which is really, really cool. So of course we hand program when there's features and things like that. We might shuffle things around, and we definitely like to be playing a lot of Australian jazz. So we make sure that balance is there, and of course working to our other quotas and stuff. So it's pretty straightforward, actually.
So before you mentioned the word story, so yeah. When people are submitting music, what kind of info do you want to see?
Yeah,
I mean, it's pretty standard to get a press release.
Yeah. This is, you know what, it's one of the things that really amazed me about the transition into radio. So I've been in radio for about 5 years, and I'm also a lecturer and an academic. And so I work with a lot of emerging artists at that university stage. And one of the things that I talk about in my job, not only at ABC but also at universities, is storytelling. I mean, that storytelling is at the core of why we make music. So if you're sending music in and saying, here's some music, and you can't access the story and you don't know what it's about and you don't know the artist and you can't find information on the artist online or even social media things, it's a little bit of a dead end. So I think the role of a of a radio presenter is to be an advocate and is to say to someone who is listening, who is getting their kids' lunches ready in the morning and they've got ABC Jazz on in the background, to say, why are you going to love this music? Why is this music perfect for you at this time of the day? And without a story, that's really hard to do because basically you've got nothing to work with. So I think it's a really, really important thing to not only think about how you're going to get your music to a radio station, but why your music? What's the story? Who are you? In my first 6 months at ABC Jazz, one local Australian artist contacted me. She's actually sitting in this room. Her name's Flora. And she wrote me a little handwritten letter and she sent her music in. And I can't tell you, Flora, I was kind of sitting there twiddling my thumbs going, I wonder when I'm going to be contacted. I wonder when people are going to reach out. I'm on air 15 hours a week. Every week, I play about 300 artists a week, and it's like people from America, like, oh, here's my music. I'm getting people from all sorts of Scandinavian countries, from Japan, you name it, no Australian artists. And it was quite astounding. I actually thought, wow, okay, you know. And then when that started to kind of trickle in and I started to put calls out and be a bit more active in social media space, you know, finding a lot of people going, okay, here's my music. But again, no stories. So as a presenter, I mean, you know, you are the advocate. You are the person saying, what is the story behind this? Because you might listen to a track and be like, that's cool. You might listen to a track and go, wow, that story is remarkable, or I now can relate to this music a lot more knowing what's behind it. Yeah.
Sure. I wanted to ask you all a question before we go to any audience questions, because we have to wrap very soon. If you had 15K to spend on promoting a record, how would you spend it? And you've got to...
Ouch.
Basically, you've got one sentence or two sentences. Jake.
I would get as many people in my immediate friendship slash team to that had probably been working with me over the previous years to work on it and try and spread that $15,000 out as far as we could and try some new things. I'm not really sure, actually. Okay. I'm going to handball.
It's a big question and it's genre dependent because I would market a hip-hop release very differently to a country release. But because I live in digital world largely, I would say firstly getting a great team of a publicist, radio person who really believes in your music and making sure they're on board to really get it out there, but then also getting a really good digital strategy and making sure that you have a plan and you pump some funds into reaching the right people online globally. It might be TikTok if you're, you know, hip-hop artists, for example, or there's still, yeah, there are some country and jazz artists using TikTok as well. Maybe TikTok, it may be Instagram. It may be a combination of a few things, but I would say digital marketing, but you need someone to help you understand who your audience is so you can reach them.
Marketing is really not my thing, so I don't want to speak to this when we've got such a wonderful panel, but I would say if it's not money related and if you don't have the 15,000, as many artists do, reach out. We're all humans. Mm. You know, we all have social media, email addresses, reach out and say, hey, I've got a question, or can we have a coffee? So that would be my advice.
Also, if it's like you're going to be doing gigs as well, then you have to realise you live in the real world and IRL, you've got to put things up around as well to remind people. So A0 posters are a classic way to do that too.
I would probably agree with all of those things, but also potentially use some of that money to make further kind of merchandise that you can sell and make money off on top of that. So I'm sure whoever is giving me this money has already pressed the records, but some other stuff that you as the artist that is not necessarily connected to the music itself, T-shirts, all that sort of stuff.
Kylie Alder's been doing tea towels too.
Tea towels,
just saying.
Lighters.
Quinton.
I think you can't do lighters anymore, but you plenty can. Of different, I think there's something to do with the printing on the things now legal. I don't know.
But you know.
Every single tiny little bit of things that you can sell, you can make, and people respond really well to that, and then you can make your money back.
I also agree with all of this. I think, like Sarah, I'm quite digital focused. And again, I love like the creative part of the artist vision is super important to me. So I would create some like awesome visuals to go with a couple of the songs, just short little ones, like just bite-sized for socials, whether it's TikTok or Instagram or whatever platform you know your audience is on. And then I think for me also like building that world and that community, as we've all touched on. And then reaching those people. So, yeah, whether that's kind of like amplifying the content that you're creating to reach that audience and, yeah, doing it that way. I will also say to Megan's point, like there's so much you can do without the money, without the $15,000, so much, you know. Sometimes it's just that social media posting and, you know, little bits on TikTok, like they can go such a long way. Outreach, you know, to radio presenters, that networking, word of mouth, it's all so important. More important, I think, than that money, you know. You got to be on the hustle.
Love it.
Can I say something?
Yes.
I'm imagining we're at a jazz festival, so most you know, genre-specific jazz is what you're all about. I think it's really important to mention that... Because jazz is such a niche genre, it's pretty much, as we, you know, we're speaking about, Sony hasn't signed any jazz artists recently. Mm-hmm. There's no point. You've got to be very realistic about where you approach. If you're making a jazz record that's semi-commercial jazz that might cross over, then you're going to have a lot more opportunities. But if you're, you know, strictly making jazz art music, I think we have to be really realistic that a lot of this stuff isn't. You know, it doesn't apply what's happening on TikTok if you've made a jazz art record. But that doesn't mean you give up. It just means that you really focus on the things that do resonate and the people that will listen to it. You know, if it's not going to be played on Triple R, well, then don't hassle Triple R, you know. But it's going to be played somewhere. You've just got to find that clan.
Yeah, and it's something we talked about earlier about setting our own expectations and what our own personal idea of success looks like. And maybe for you, getting played on Triple R is a real dream come true. Maybe you want to be played on BBC. Maybe being rotation ABC Jazz is for you. But it really, you know, there is no right or wrong and there is no gold medal. It's not a race. It's not sport. It's very different. And it's not about how many zeros, you know, are in your bank account or not, or if you win awards or not. It's about making the music that you feel really passionate about. And all of these things that we've been talking about today are just mechanisms to support getting your message out and communicating your art. And that's all it's really about. And it's not, you know, different levels of success is great, but it's something we all need to reflect on continuously is why do I make art? Why do I participate in music? What do I want from it? And what do I want it to look like? And then you can set an expectation that's realistic for you and go, these are the goals and things I want to achieve. And so you're not heartbroken that you didn't get the front page of Beat magazine or whatever it is. We are going to go and have our drinks very soon, and so there'll be a real opportunity for questions with all of the panellists. But did anyone have a specific question they wanted to ask before we wrap? Oh, Chris, yes.
Being part of the Melbourne International Jazz Festival, I was wondering if we could just give another round of applause to Mildlife again for winning the ARIA of the Jazz. Legends. That's it.
Brilliant. Well, thanks again for joining Panic at the Distro. I hope you feel less panicked and more equipped to navigate releasing your recordings, and can't wait to hear more music from all of you. Please put your hands together for our incredible panel. Marietta Uzas, Will Evans, Chris Gill, Megan Beslam, Sarah Appleton, Jake Mason. Thanks so much. We'll see you at Blondie.
That was Panic at the Distro, recorded at Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress. Please keep in touch with Melbourne International Jazz Festival by subscribing to our e-news at melbournejazz.com. Follow us on social media and subscribe on your preferred platform for more podcast episodes. We would like to thank Principal Partners Creative Victoria and the Australia Council, the Vizard Foundation, the Rise Fund, an Australian Government Initiative, the Helen McPherson Smith Trust, and the US Consulate.